All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Thursday, October 5th, 2020. Of course, my website is therealistreport.com, where you will find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other programs I've participated in. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, a contact page, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to the Barnes Review, the bi-monthly revisionist history magazine. Please do subscribe to these fine print publications. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for all the details. All right, with that said, let me introduce our special guest today. The one and only Germar Rudolph is joining us for the very first time. Germar, welcome to the program. How are you this morning, sir?
Well, thank you for having me. I'm doing fine. And yourself?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. It's been past couple days have been crazy with this election going on, this still unresolved election. And I think it's pretty clear that they're trying to steal this thing from Trump. So we'll have to kind of wait and see what happens with that. But we have a number of other important topics to discuss here this morning. So, and it's really an honor to have you here. I've been very much influenced by your writing and your work over the years. I've heard you interviewed on other programs, and I've always wanted to have you as a guest here. So I'm glad that you were able to join me this morning, and I thank you for taking the time. And, you know, kind of just to get started, could you maybe just introduce yourself a little bit, give us a little bit of background, and your, you know, kind of explain your experience in the revisionist movement and what led you, you know, into critically investigating the World War II narrative and specifically the alleged Jewish Holocaust of 6 million Jews during this monumental period of history?
Yes, well, that's a question that the answer to which could take an hour already, but I'll make it shorter than that. I'm a native German, so I grew up in Germany. I got my school and university education in Germany. I finished with a master's degree or an equivalent of that in chemistry back in 1989, and then started a year later after doing my compulsory military service. I started working on a PhD in chemistry, and it was around that time that the Leuchter report was issued. That was in 1988. I found out about it in 1989 and was curious about it. I had a keen interest in German history for years, but I never touched upon the Holocaust. It was too hot a topic, too unpleasant a topic for Germans, I would say. There may be a number of them who make a career out of it, of doing the mea culpa thing. There are a lot of them actually in Germany, but it wasn't my thing. So I stayed away from it. German history for me that was of interest was the Kaiser time, First World War, and the run up to the Second World War, and how the Second World War got started and the aftermath. But I kind of stayed out of the war itself because it's just too bloody a topic. And of course, in particular, the Holocaust. What changed it was a book that I read just a few months before I found out about the Leuchter Report. And that was a book by French historian Paul Racigny, who is considered the founder of historical revisionism. He himself had been in a concentration camp because he had helped Jews getting illegal papers to get out of occupied France. And he ended up at the Buchenwald camp and after the war wrote about it and was not pleased by the exaggerations and lies that were spread by his fellow inmates. And that was his starting point. And when I obtained a book of his in spring 1989, I was amazed. Up to that point, anyone who was questioning the Orthodox Holocaust narrative for me was just a Nazi, a right-wing extremist, an anti-Semite, and all the kind of labels that are put on people who question the Holocaust. And I was among those mainstream people who automatically, in a Pavlovian reflex, would you know, throw these words at people who would dare to doubt. But this guy, I couldn't do that with him because he was a victim of National Socialism. He had been inside a concentration camp as a prisoner. He had suffered terribly. And yet there he was doubting the whole narrative and bringing up arguments against the gas chamber claims, which opened up my mind, allowed me to have doubts to question the thing itself. I did not yet do it, but the preparation of my mind, the opening up of my mind was there. And then a few months later, I happened to stumble over the Leuchter Report, which, of course, in one of its sections talks about taking wall samples and analyzing them chemically. Now, of course, I just had graduated in chemistry a year before, roughly a year before, and that was my field of expertise. History had been a hobby, a field of interest, but I never felt like I could contribute in any way to it because I'm not a historian by any stretch of the imagination, just a consumer, an aficionado, if you wish. But there was a topic where I thought, well, that I can understand, that I can verify, that I can actually maybe even contribute to. And that's how I got going on that. And what I was doing then a year later, starting my PhD at a Max Planck Institute for Solid State Research in Stuttgart, I realized that they have a fine research library and they had online research back then in 1990, 1991, there was no such thing as the internet yet, but there was an intranet of worldwide libraries that were already connected and communicating in a similar fashion as it was then expanded to encompass everyone in the World Wide Web. So there was a pre-existing web, and it was fantastic. I could use it without getting charged. I could do all the research I wanted. And in spare time, when I was not working on my PhD, I went there and had the librarians work for me on that topic of, well, what chemicals are being formed? How are they being formed? And what kind of chemistry is going on? And what conditions had been prevalent and would be needed? And all these questions that were raised, I started to answer, not because I was planning on doing anything with it. I was just curious. It was just pure curiosity because it was, in my mind, too important a topic to ignore it and to leave it half done. Because that was my impression when I read the Leuchter Report. He just took the samples, had them analyzed, got the results, and then said, well, because the results are not as I expect them, that proves that there was not any mass gassings going on in Auschwitz. But for my opinion back then and still today, he kind of jumped the gun because there were so many questions that were not properly answered, like the chemical compound that he has been looking for in his analysis. Could they be long-term stable enough to survive 40 years? Because between the end of the war and the time he took the samples, we're talking about roughly 40 years. Would they have been able to survive? Unless you can give a definitive answer to that, it makes little sense to take samples. And then the next question is, well, of course, if we have established, and I did that then with doing a lot of research, that they do survive 40 years or more, so it makes sense to look for them analytically, could they form in the first place? What were the conditions that are claimed to have been present during those mass gassings, the physical conditions, the chemical conditions, the actual conditions of what happened exactly, what concentrations were used, and how quickly was it ventilated, could it have been ventilated? All these questions that came up to my mind and that I think had to be answered, and I couldn't find the answer in the Leuchter Report. So he left me high and dry and thirsting for more, and that's what I was just doing for my own curiosity's sake. But I knew there are a lot of people out there who would be interested in any findings, and as soon as I had my first findings in early 1991 that showed that this chemical which was analyzed, which was detected by those analyses, it's called, there's an umbrella term that's called iron blue. And there are some subsets of it called Prussian blue and Tunbridge blue and all kinds of other names used for it. But it's a blue pigment, essentially, that's a combination of iron and cyanide. And cyanide is the part which comes from Zyklon B, which is the infamous product said to have been used to mass murder Jews in Auschwitz. So I found out with a number of peer-reviewed papers that had been published in the 50s, 60s, and 70s that this pigment is indeed extremely stable and should survive with ease those 40 years between World War II and the time Richter had taken his samples. And I sent those papers, I just made copies of the papers and sent them to a list of people and institutions that I had received from a friend of mine who told me they might be interested. I didn't know any of these people. I just sent it out. It was some 20 people or so. And one of them must have become interested in me expanding that research because he contacted me and invited me and then asked me whether I'd be willing to myself go to Auschwitz, take samples and do similar analysis. And I happily agreed to do that. I took a few days off from my employment as a PhD student to go on an extended weekend to Auschwitz. And we did our research there, took samples and had them analyzed. And fortunately, that Max Planck Institute also had a nice engineering department where you could get, as a PhD student there, you could get your own machinery built. So if you were doing some experiments or were planning on doing some novel experience, you need a novel machine, a novel setup to do your experiments, they would actually construct it for you. So I had an engineer friend of mine make construction drawings of a experimental little gas chamber that we could use to expose building materials to hydrogen cyanide, to Zyklon B fumes, essentially, to see how they react, to verify that my chemical findings were accurate. And the Max Planck Institute actually built it for me at their expense. As a matter of fact, it sounds a little bit spurious that I did that, but I had a contract with the Max Planck Institute, the Max Planck Society. Actually, the full name is Max Planck Society for the Furthering of Science. So what they do is their mission is to further science in any which way possible. And the contract I have with them allowed me to do my PhD, but allowed me also expressively in the chapter, it says that any student who wants to do his own research on his own initiative is encouraged and invited to do so and use the Institute's resources for it. Bingo.
Wow.
Because at the end of the day, they didn't like what I did with it. And then they eventually wanted to fire me because I had done that. And it went to court because I thought, you can't do this. You know, I have the contract here. It says expressively I'm allowed to do it. And we'll settle then out of court, and the contract with them was resolved 2 or 3 months before it would come to a normal end. Anyhow, it was only a limited contract of 3 years. So anyway, that was the setup. And the guy who actually contacted me and asked me whether I wanted to do that research and take my own samples, he was in contact with a lawyer who had clients who were on trial or were prosecuted and soon to be on trial for quote-unquote Holocaust denial. And they then asked me to get all my results together, write an expert report that could be presented in court in Germany, which I did. And then I appeared in some 7 or 8 court cases as an expert witness. However, I was never heard by the court because they basically violated German penal code because it says if an expert witness is already in the courtroom, so to say, there's no expense and no time wasted for the court to get this witness. The witness is already there. He is an expert by his education, which I was. I mean, don't need a PhD degree to be an expert already if you have a diploma degree, which is somewhere between a master's degree and a PhD degree in the US. If you have that already, you are considered an expert in chemistry and you can testify. And if you are in control of your mind, so you're not under the influence of some drugs or so, or unconscious, then you can't testify, of course. And if what you have to say is relevant to the case, which it is, because those people were on trial for denying that there were gassings in Auschwitz, and I could prove or explain to the court what could and could not happen according to the material evidence that I found. So what I would testify was relevant. Under these circumstances, the German Penal Code forces a court to hear the evidence. They cannot reject it. It's already there. It's relevant. It's possible. Do it. But no, they broke the law and denied me to testify anyway. And in one case, the judge actually threatened me. Now, this is a crime under German penal law to threaten a witness in the witness stand or in the courtroom that if he testifies to his best knowledge, that he would get prosecuted for it. And that's exactly what that judge did. He said, witness, are you really going to testify along the line as the motion of the defense suggests? And said, well, you will hear. And when I'm in the stand. So I didn't even answer to that. But then he said, well, if you do testify along those lines, you are making yourself liable to prosecution because it's going to be in a crime. So he was threatening me as a witness that if I testify in a certain way, that I would be prosecuted. But that's the standard procedure in Germany. And back then, actually, you could still file motions as a lawyer to have evidence like that introduced. That changed in the meantime because of me, because of my appearance. So they wanted to put a stop to it. So they changed case law and said, by a Supreme Court decision that a lawyer who files a motion to introduce evidence, which by its contents denies the Holocaust, the lawyer actually commits a crime and will be prosecuted merely for filing the motion. That does not even include the evidentiary statement itself, but only suggests that a statement would go along this line. And then this is already considered a crime, and several lawyers were prosecuted and sentenced in Germany for having done exactly that. And the first case that set the precedent was when a lawyer filed a motion to have me testify. So
yeah, it's pretty unbelievable where literally in Germany, if you present evidence that questions or criticizes the official Holocaust story, it's literally a crime for presenting authentic, legitimate evidence. You know, it's totally tyrannical and Orwellian to a degree that I can't even express.
Right. It's the step before. They don't even get to present it. They just file a motion. I would like to present this evidence. That is already a crime. You don't even get to present the evidence. Yeah, it's ridiculous. So, yeah. And after seeing, you know, initially the first couple of years I was doing that, I was chasing the system ahead of me. They were panicking. Judges were panicking. It was big upheaval and they were trying to stop me. They would do anything to stop me. And they did eventually. I mean, they dragged me in court for my expert report and sentenced me. And I left the country before it actually became valid because it was an appeal was pending and I had not been arrested for it. Because they thought there's no danger that I might flee because I was married, I had children, I had a job, I had a home. So they thought, no, I'm not going to run. And I did. And I lived abroad for a number of years, expanding my activities in this regard, turning what was initially only research on a small level into a publishing enterprise that was focusing on this issue, expanding more and more the research horizon, not just Auschwitz, but all the camps, not just the camps, but the whole topic of the Holocaust and not just me. I mean, I'm a minor contributor at this point. I'm primarily editing and publishing. Other authors, particularly the Italian scholar Carlo Martogno, who I consider to be the world's foremost expert in matters of Holocaust in general. He has published monographs on pretty much anything you can imagine of with a few exceptions maybe. But he covered the whole territory, and he has a knowledge that is rivaled by no one, not even mainstream historians. They cannot touch him with anything, with the depth and intensity of knowledge that he has. He would blow any orthodox historian out of the water with ease.
Yeah.
And I have the pleasure and the honor to publish his material. Actually, right now I'm working on getting another one of his books translated from Italian to English. I've turned into a translator and editor mainly. I'm doing translations now. I've been doing for the past 2 or 3 years from Italian on some regular basis. So I have passive knowledge of Italian only, though. And that's what I'm doing nowadays.
Very good. Yeah, no, and you're doing a great job. You've been doing a great job for a number of years. You know, and I wanted to ask you because your main forensic and chemical investigations into the alleged Holocaust really kind of focuses on Auschwitz, correct? That was like the main camp that you kind of focused on?
Yes. I exclusively focused on Auschwitz simply because I was a student that didn't have the means of traveling to other camps and doing research on them as well. Auschwitz is kind of the big elephant in the room anyhow, if we're talking about the Holocaust, by terms of propagandistic importance from the Orthodox sites, in terms of number of victims, in terms of the documentation that has been left, because pretty much most of the camp archives from the construction office as well as from the headquarters have survived. And also when it comes to the number of witness statements we have, because there are so many Auschwitz survivors, they go in the hundreds of thousands after the war, which already tells you a lot about how successful an alleged extermination could have been that is said to have happened there. If hundreds of thousands are left after the war, are allowed to survive and tell the story to the world. As a matter of fact, had these things that are claimed happened, you would have 100,000 or even 200,000 testimonies pretty much saying the same thing. But we don't have them. We have maybe maybe 50 that are relevant in terms of someone claiming he actually saw something in person. We have lots more that repeat rumors and that regurgitate what's been published in the media. But actual people who claim, I was there, I did that, and I saw that, there may be 50, maybe 100. But if you consider you have 200,000 survivors and 100 of them come up with a story and the other 199,900 don't, then you have a pretty good statistical idea of where the truth is. Under 200,000 people, you find 100 pathetic liars, and they are.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I wanted to ask you, and it's kind of a broad question, but what are the main conclusions that you've come to regarding Auschwitz and how it fits into the overall, you know, Holocaust story?
Well, they're pretty much the same as Leuchter's. They're based on a much broader basis of evidence, and I'm not blaming Leuchter for not having been able to do that, because he was asked in the middle of a trial to do within a few days, which normally you wouldn't do because the topic is so complex. He couldn't have done the preparatory research on any level to actually allow him to come to these conclusions. So I think he was pushing it a little bit. But basically, I'm saying the same thing. If we look at the facilities where it's claimed to have happened, we look at their technical, the engineering, their architectural design and capabilities, you can say that already from that point of view, these facilities would not have been able to do what is claimed to have happened in them. And then you come to the chemical part, and I prove with a lot of research, first of all, the components that we analyze are so stable that we need to find them to this day, and they actually would have formed because they are numerous factors, chemical and physical in nature, which I can back up with a lot of expert literature from normal chemical and physical peer-reviewed journals, you know, the mainstream journals that publish that kind of research, showing that, yeah, this stuff would have formed under the circumstances, and actually the homicidal gas chambers would have been the primary place where we should expect them because of their chemical and physical makeup. So basically, it's coming to the same conclusion on a much wider evidentiary basis, also because I happen to revise my report, getting more and more access to material that is in the archives of the Auschwitz Museum, in the Moscow archives, because the Red Army kind of took most of the documents that I found in Auschwitz and took them to Moscow, and they released them only in the mid-1990s. And we got a hold of them, and Mikhail Matonia has done analysis of a lot of this material from all these archives, and I have a good working relationship with him, so I get a lot of the material that's interesting and have used them for newer editions of my report to further substantiate the conclusions that I had already come to in my first edition of 1992. Basically, the facilities couldn't have done it, and the chemical evidence shows that it didn't happen.
Right. So, well, I mean, and you know, Auschwitz is presented as this like mass extermination center, right? Like at least by the, you know, mainstream court historians. So what was going on at Auschwitz then? I mean, if it wasn't this, you know, death camp, I mean, what was really going on there?
It was a death camp, but not a murder camp. There's a difference. Auschwitz initially was just a normal concentration camp where primarily Polish political prisoners and resistance fighters were incarcerated. And that changed after the start of the German-Soviet war in summer of 1941, at which point they wanted to build in the vicinity of Auschwitz a huge POW camp where they planned on housing 100,000 or even 200,000 Soviet prisoners of war. Now, if you look into the history of the war, the Germans had millions of Soviet POWs, but they were all grounded somewhere in Russia, and there was no logistical means for them to actually get millions of people back west, because their transport infrastructure to get soldiers, munitions, and supplies to the front and back were so strained that they just didn't have the capacity to get any of the Soviet people, Soviet prisoners, out of there, or very few. And of course, when then winter broke out relatively early that year in October, November already, things were completely shut down. And then the Soviet prisoners of war in those, they were not really prisoner of war camps. They just put them in a spot, put some barbed wire around them, some people with machine guns, and guarded them that way, because they were just not prepared for this sudden huge amount of prisoners. And they started dying like flies. So the plans to have that POW camp near Auschwitz, which then was called Birkenau, filled with Soviet POWs, didn't work out. They wanted to use those POWs to work in the chemical factories that were being constructed at that time nearby, which was absolutely crucial for the German war effort, because basically Germany manufactured the most important things for conducting war, that is fuel, ammunitions, and all kinds of basic chemicals that are used to run any kind of machinery, rubber, lubricants, everything. They were synthesizing it out of air and coal. So they had planned on using the coal mines in Upper Silesia to get the coal, get them into coal liquefaction and gasification plants near Auschwitz, which they were building there, because there's a lot of processed water. The rivers of Vistula and the Sola have a lot of water. For the process, you need water. And they wanted to build this huge factory, which would produce fuel, lubricants, and other chemicals to fuel the machinery. And they needed workers for it. So they planned on using the POWs for working in those factories. And then they didn't come. So the plan B was, which they switched to then in early 1942, when they knew they can't get the Russian POWs out of Russia, to used the Jews. The Jews of Europe, they started deporting from Czechoslovakia and then from France. Jews and put them in the POW camp instead. It took them 2 years, actually, to rename the camp from POW to concentration camp. So initially they kept the name, even though it was never really was a POW camp. It was filled with Jews. And when they started filling it up with Jews in early 1942, there was not much of a camp. It was pretty much similar, like with all the other camps. Initially, they put a barbed wire fence around an area, threw the people in there, and gave them some boards and some hammers and some nails, and told them, build your own barracks, build your own huts, build your own beds, and that's it. Not a nice situation for anyone. So up to the end of 1942, the first three-quarter years, there were basically no sanitary facilities worth mentioning, no proper toilets, no showers at all, no delousing facilities. And you can imagine if you cram people together in an area that only is developing housing, that is only developing sanitary installations, the hygienic conditions are going to be catastrophic, which they were. And right from the beginning, they were infested with lice and flea, inevitably, if you cram people together and they can't wash and shower and their clothes don't get deloused, then you have these vermin spread like crazy. And it's only a matter of time during wartime that disease are spread by these pests. You know, fleas spread the plague, lice spread typhus. The plague, fortunately, did not break out in those years, even though we see from the documents that the German authorities were afraid it might. But the lice did introduce typhus, and right from the beginning, people started dying like flies in that camp because of the hygienic situation, because of typhus spreading like crazy. It reached its peak in August and September of 1942, so just not even half a year after they've started shipping Jews into that camp. And the peak, I think, was that 500 inmates died on one day. I think it was either late August or in September, I can't remember exactly. But it stayed around several hundreds throughout from July into October, when it subsided a little bit, but it resurged again in early 1943, and as they got it under control only toward the end of 43, early 1944. So during this time, for large stretches, hundreds of people died every day on this typhus epidemic. And it was so bad that actually the SS guards and the SS officials, they were supposed to run the camp, at least remotely, getting some inmates in charge inside who would run it for them inside. But there had to be, of course, some interaction between the SS and the inmates. And the SS people succumbed to typhus as well. It was the very first garrison physician of Auschwitz, Dr. Schreler, who got sick of it in April or May of 42, and he died in May. And the next one put in charge, Dr. Uhlenbrock, got sick of it too in September, and he barely survived, but he was incapacitated for a month. And the next physician they put in charge, he came from the Dachau concentration camp, was put in charge then in September. He took over. And he is described in letters he wrote after the war, what situation he found when he came to Auschwitz, that there was no sanitary facilities, the people were filthy, they were covered in lice, and fleas were everywhere. You could see everything crawling in the huts. It just looks like the wood everywhere is moving because there are just lice and fleas everywhere. It was absolutely horrific. Dead inmates lying in bunks, not being removed for sometimes days, because there was just no organization, no structure. And it was Dr. Witz, the third garrison physician, who then moved heaven and earth to get things improved. It took him 2 years to get it under control. But if you consider the completely chaotic conditions were completely out of control, they had so many people die there that they had only one crematorium, the main camp, the original concentration camp. And they couldn't burn it all there because it just didn't have the capacity. And then they overloaded that and it broke down anyhow. So they had to bury most of these victims for a period of time in the second half of 1942 in mass graves. And as I mentioned, this is an area where the rivers Vistula and Sola flow together. So it's a low-lying meadowland and it's swampy. And if you dig up mass graves there and throw thousands of people in there, they are going to be in the groundwater and they are going to rot and they are going to poison the groundwater. And that was the danger, that the groundwater in the entire area would get poisoned and that other diseases caused by it that gets transferred through drinking water, typhoid fever and cholera and whatever else can get into it. That you have not only typhus, but typhoid fever, which is a different thing. And then you have cholera. All things can happen. So they were freaking out. And then they had inmates actually excavate those mass graves again and try to incinerate the rotting leftovers of those typhus victims to make sure they wouldn't poison the groundwater. So it is a complete nightmarish scenario that I'm describing to you here. And it's allegedly also the same time when mass gassings are supposed to have happened. Now, if you imagine how completely out of control the situation was for the SS, where the SS men themselves are dying and they have no means of getting a hand and a control of the situation. It is unfathomable that on top of all this, they would start mass murdering Jews that were being shipped to Auschwitz. As a matter of fact, we know from the documentation that all the Jews up to July 1942 that were ever shipped to Auschwitz, and that can be proved to have been shipped there, were properly registered there and entered the camp as normal inmates, so they weren't mass murdered. So mass murder claims for the first half of 1942 are completely bogus. There's no documentary evidence for it. But considering how completely out of control the situation was, the SS could not possibly have had the logistical means to organize, to implement, and then to clean up such a mass murder program, because they were already completely unable to handle the quote-unquote natural death cases they had on hand. So you can see that yes, Auschwitz during that phase was a death camp, but not because of murder, but because of mass dying due to the absolutely outrageous conditions that prevailed in the camp during the first year. It got better only, as I said, when Dr. Wirtz came. He had showers built, delousing facilities built. He actually saw even to it that the most modern delousing device ever created was installed at Auschwitz. It's a microwave delousing facility. The Germans had discovered microwave during the Olympics in 1936 with their strong TV emitters that had a broad band spectrum that went into the microwave, and they were frying flies that were getting near to the emitters. That's when they realized, oh, look at this. At that frequency range, actually, radiation does something that radio waves don't do. It heats up water and kills every bug. So they started developing, it was Siemens, started developing delousing devices based on microwave radiation. And the first one was ready in 1943, and eventually it got sent to Auschwitz, and then Auschwitz got a stationary installation in 1944, roughly around the same time when they also got the first DDT, which, as you know, was invented by a Swiss chemical company, and they licensed it out to German companies, to American companies, and they all started using it in 1943, 1944, and Auschwitz got its first tons of DDT in May of 1944. And at that point, things were under control. I'm not talking about DDT being a good thing, as we know down the road, it had its very detrimental environmental effects. But at that point, it saved the lives of thousands of people, if not tens of thousands of people, and got all the epidemics that were raging in Europe under control. And among them, ones in Auschwitz, in addition to the microwave systems that they had built there.
Very interesting. That's probably the best explanation of Auschwitz that I've heard ever. So thank you for explaining all of that. And it really kind of shows you, I mean, the Germans absolutely did not have like the state-sanctioned policy of murdering Jews. They were just dealing with a very chaotic situation with all these people in their control, right? I mean, I think that's really kind of what it boils down to. They weren't prepared. They didn't have the resources. That's kind of what you're getting at? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when we're talking about the local people at Auschwitz, they have numerous times, both Dr. Wirtz and the camp command said, stop shipping Jews to us. We can't handle the situation. The responsibility for what evolved there lies clearly with the Reich government, with the Reichssicherheitshauptamt, the main office in charge of, you know, basically Nazi Germany's Department for Homeland Security, who decided we have to have people work in our factories. All the men are at the front. We have no workforce anymore, and now we are trying to get volunteers from foreign countries. They are not enough. So Jews were the primary scapegoat of the National Socialists. So they picked those. You're going to be our slave laborers, and then they shipped them to Auschwitz, even though they were informed. Sooner. And there's some responsibility with the SS at Auschwitz. They tried to cover it up, the disastrous situation. They weren't screaming bloody murder loud enough, if at all, early on. They should have done that. It was only Dr. Wirtz who started doing that. But still then, the Reich government wouldn't stop shipping Jews down there. Now, I mean, starting in July and August of 1942, most Jews were not were deported into the Auschwitz region were not admitted to the camp anymore. And that's where the mainstream narrative comes from. They said, okay, we have this train. We know it left Compiègne, say, in France with 1,000 Jews. And we see then in the camp records that only, say, 150 of them had been admitted to the camp. So we conclude that 850 of them were killed on arrival in gas chambers. But that's not true. We have found documents that shows very clearly in July the typhus epidemic was completely out of control, and it was decided then to not send the Jews into the camp anymore, but to take them off trains at other places and let them work in factories and let the factories set up little workers' camps in their vicinity. So there were a lot of them in the vicinity of Auschwitz where people were, the inmates were temporarily housed because the Auschwitz camp was completely out of control, and it was just irresponsible to send people there. Still, they did admit a lot of people. If you look at the people, the French Jews who were sent to Auschwitz in 1942, all of them who were sent there until early July were properly registered. We have their names, and we see also in the death books where all inmates that died are recorded that one after one of these people died. So most of these French Jews, indeed, they were shipped in mass to Auschwitz, even though the conditions there were terrible. The Reich government just didn't care. They wanted them there. They wanted them to work. And if they have bad conditions, too bad, just see to it that they get better. We need to get this done. And then they died like flies. And at the end, you can see all the names. Not a single one of these 70,000 Jews that were deported was killed in a gas chamber. We can see it. They died of typhus and all the other bad things that happened there because of the conditions. But most of them did die, and within a year.
Oops. I'm curious because, I mean, you know, most people are aware that Auschwitz originally, I think in, you know, up until the early 90s, if I'm not mistaken, I mean, the official narrative was that 3 million people were murdered. And
four.
Then was it 4? Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And then they reduced it down to 1 million, I think, now is like the official narrative. So how many people total? I mean, do you have any idea, like, how many people actually died during the war at Auschwitz? I mean, it certainly wasn't 4 million. It probably wasn't even 1 million. How many people do you think actually died there?
The death books, which officially recorded every death case in the camp of inmates that were registered in the camp, The volumes of the death books that have been released to the public have recorded around 68,000 death cases. Roughly half of them are Jews. And the rest are mainly Poles, Christian Poles who were there. Now, this set is incomplete. We know from a accompanying letter of the Russian archives that they do have more, but it seems like they have not released those and they keep them hidden, or they have been destroyed in the meantime. So there is a set missing that goes, if I'm not mistaken, from end of 33 all through 1944. And there are a few volumes here and there missing, and at the beginning too. Now, from the conditions that prevailed, we can see that probably the death rates shrank dramatically toward the end of 43 and into 1944. And that is maybe one reason why they are hiding them and not releasing them, because they clearly show that Auschwitz camp got the situation under control and there were relatively little death cases during that time. But we can set an upper limit of what is possible of by a number of logistical factors that we extrapolate things, and if we look at the conditions, and also if we look what would have been possible to destroy when we come to talking about cremation, because evidently Auschwitz, with the situation they were, they couldn't bury people in mass graves, so they had to cremate them, and they built crematoria, and we know what capacity they have. We know for good stretches what fuels they got delivered. We know how much fuel you need, and we can make calculations what is the maximum number of people that could have been cremated there, and we know that there are no huge mass graves, and the narrative doesn't even claim that after these initial typhus victims that there were any people buried in mass graves. So they all need to be have to be cremated in those crematoria, but there are technical limits of what they could have achieved in that time with that fuel and with the equipment they had. And so the upper limit is maybe roughly double the amount that is recorded in those death books. So we're talking 140,000 as an upper limit. But this is really definitely an upper limit. It's probably a little less. We're talking about order of magnitude of 100,000, you know, plus minus a few 10,000 up and down. And if you consider this in comparison to what has been claimed, 1 million or even 4 million, it sounds like little. It sounds like a minimization, a trivialization of what has happened in Auschwitz. But give me a break. We have one camp that existed basically only during a few years during the war, and roughly 100,000 people die there because of prevailing catastrophic conditions for which the SS and the Reich government is responsible. And if they can't provide proper amenities for the inmates to be able to survive, they ship them there anywhere. It's their responsibility. 100,000 people is a huge number. And I find it shocking that people don't find such a number shocking, but consider it, that it is a trivialization and a mockery. No, it's not. It's 100,000 individual fates of death. It's in the realm of the concentration camp that existed in Germany, where you know Buchenwald, you know Mauthausen, Dachau, and all the other ones. They all have their death toll. None of them are claimed to have had mass gassings going on. There are some minor claims of test gassings here and there, but not numerically significant. None of these come anywhere close to the death toll that Auschwitz has. So even if we take the revisionist narrative of it, this camp still has been the main location of loss of life of catastrophic, of tragic loss of life in that concentration camp system. So that's why I'm saying it was a death camp in that term, not because of murder, not because of gas chambers. Just the other day, I mentioned to an acquaintance of mine who was not familiar with my views on that, and we got to talk about it. And I said, you know, genocide does not require gas chambers. In fact, the whole history of mankind is riddled with genocides, and not a single one of them included mass gassings and gas chambers. So why do you insist on this one having had gas chambers? If you look at the definition of genocide, you know, you persecute a defined group in a way that its numbers, its population numbers shrinks due to your measures of preventing birth, of preventing families to form, of putting them under conditions where they die in masses. This is today's definition, and today's definition still applies even if you take out the gas chambers. So the genocide charge, ethically speaking, not legally speaking, because the law didn't exist back then, but today it does, but ethically it's always been there. The genocide charge doesn't go away.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, even 100,000, as you mentioned, I mean, that is itself a tragedy. You know, 100,000 people, that's a small city, you know, just dying in one camp in these horrible conditions. And that really is important to understand and to consider that, you know, it really was this really horrific situation, not a state-sanctioned policy by the Germans, but just given the environment, given the conditions, given the war, and just how strained the German government was, it probably was a pretty irresponsible thing to do, and it did lead to a lot of death.
Right. And well, of course, nowadays Germany has to deal with it morally, but they, of course, pile up stuff on top of it, which is inaccurate and is just exaggeration or outright lie. This is just not right either.
Yes, exactly. Well, we could probably spend another 2 hours discussing this or even more. I know you're going to have to run here in just a minute. I wanted you to briefly kind of just promote your website and also your fundraiser. I know you've had a number of legal challenges and legal issues over the years, both here in the United States and, of course, in Germany. And I know recently you're sort of facing a legal situation that I wanted you to kind of talk about briefly, if you have just a couple more minutes.
Sure. Well, I actually don't want to expand too much on it. I have my own personal website where you can find a brief introduction to it, and then a short video I did. It's posted on YouTube. You find the link there. And my website is just my name. So it's germarudolf.com. G-E-R-M-A-R Rudolf, R-U-D-O-L-F.com. And right on the homepage there, you find a little attention catcher paragraph that explains the trials and tribulations I've been going through, and a video where it explains it and gets you also to a GoFundMe page or gives you other options there on the website to donate if you feel so inclined. But what I also want to point out, and that is more to the topic, is that there are other websites that are more of interest to those who are curious about the topic we've been talking about. And the main one is probably holocausthandbooks.com, where we have posted for free download as ebooks, PDF, Kindle, and EPUB, almost all of the volumes of our Holocaust Handbook series, which comprises 40 volumes by now, and it keeps growing. And it also has some documentary movies there, which you can watch in case moving in pictures are more your thing rather than reading. And you'll find links there to purchase hard copies of it. And the shop that I'm actually operating is connected with CODO, the Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust. And the website is shop.codo.com. CODO is CODOH.com. But as I said, you find the link on our holocausthandbooks.com website, and that's probably the best point to start it. It has recommendations on what to read if you want an introduction, starting with simple leaflets to brochures to booklets, going to lengthier books and actually thick tomes, depending on what you're looking for. And then we have the documentaries there and links to if you want to buy something, and you can go from there. That's probably the best starting point.
Very good. I will definitely have that linked, and I will also have your personal website linked and then your GoFundMe page as well. And I would encourage people to support you, whether that's by donating directly to the GoFundMe or purchasing books from your website. So, yeah, thanks a lot, man. I appreciate you taking the time. We'll have to do this again and maybe spend a little bit more time discussing the Holocaust. There's no shortage of information to discuss, that's for sure.
I'm already on the call that I was expecting now, so I have to run.
Okay. Thanks, Garmar. Have a good one. I'll talk to you soon.
Yep.
Bye.